Mr. James, Reel 44. So that was while you were at the IRTD.
Yes.
Going back to your time with the old Garrison Company, any other incidents from that era of your career?
Anyone?
Any other incidents from that era of your career?
Well, no. I remember that time. The time came. I told Captain Weston that I intended to go out. And he was very disappointed because he was going to lose me. He gave me a marvellous reference. And so what happened was that when he knew that I wanted to go out, he set the wheels rolling and he informed the authorities. And they sent me documentation for my release, and because of my length of service and knowing that my service would be the 22nd of February, they gave me leave to start in December. And so I had so much leave that expired so really speaking, I was allowed to leave the army in December, although my date could be the 22nd of February, my leave could take me up to that point. And I came home in December.
So can you describe that process from you last night?
Yes, well,
what happened from then on?
It was farewell to everybody, and so I was leaving for home the next day, and I had to go to Villa.
Did you have like a night out or what did you do?
Well, I time came for me to say goodbye to Bologna, and I didn't have a last night or anything like that. There was nothing to celebrate. I remember particularly the following morning I was going by train to Villach, where I'd be going through a sausage machine for Portugal. And we arrived in Austria, and stayed there for the usual day until they could organize the train journey from Vienna to the UK via Calais.
What was Vienna? What
it is? It was what the 27th said it was in Milan. It was the Bidmob Center.
So you were going through the same system?
I was going through the Bidmob Center at Vienna, or as a Japanese in the army, to be sent from Vienna to the UK and all sort of thing. There were certain things to be handed in, arms and whatnot. And I travelled.
What else did you have to hand in?
I think myself that we travelled quite light. We were travelling soldiers to Woking. We knew we were going to UK, but we were going to Woking in Surrey, where we were going to have our city clothes and hand in all the military stuff. I rather think that we handed in the majority of our kit in Villach, and we were travelling quite light with just our hand baggage and ourselves, comfortably, to Woking, to Mock Centre in Surrey, which is where we eventually were conducted to from Vienna. And I remember particularly at Woking, handing in my uniform. I was given a suit. I was given a great trilby hat, which had a terrible small head. And they were given this enormous trilby hat and a back. And it was all sort of the mob stuff. Everybody knew that the mob suit. Wasn't a very smart thing, you know. They were grey, you had a choice of a grey one, and they weren't very well tailored either. And I was kitted out at Woking in my demob suit and a mac, and a grey trilby. And I remember particularly, though, I did bring my warrant officer class one mac that I acquired in Milan. It was a trench coat. It was an officer's, a real officer's trench coat, which I was allowed to buy in Milan. And we knew there were no cupboards in England. But there were cupboards in England for clothing. And you couldn't have any clothes unless you had enough coupons for a suit. We were given enough coupons for a suit instead of Israel, because I remember that as soon as I arrived, I didn't like my demob suit. I went to Leeds by train with my coupons just to buy myself a suit.
Why did you have to go to Leeds?
Well, somebody told me that all the Jews were in Leeds and that they had suits on the hangers ready for. You wouldn't get them. They told me that because of the war, you're very lucky to find something ready made. But if I went to Leeds, I would. And it was famous for all the Jews that were there, the Jewish tailors. I was told that if I went to Leeds by train, got out of the train and crossed the road, I'd see 10 tailor shops. You know, this is what about to tell me. And that's what I did. I went to Leeds to get a suit. Can you believe it? And I can remember the very suit I bought. I bought a smashing brown double-breasted suit that was on the hook, on the hanger. And out of the train, into the outfitters, saw the suit I wanted, tried it on, paid it, and back in the train within a half an hour. I came back.
So it was true, the story?
It was. But I mean, it was. This is what I did. Anyway, and that was the first thing I did.
When you got out of the army.
When I got out of the army.
Just backtracking a little bit, obviously you would know that there were shortages in England of various things. Were you and your colleagues coming back from Italy, did you bring anything back specifically because of the shortages?
Well,
did you stock up on any?
Really, I remember, I mean, I had a trench coat, and I knew that I was going to have a cheap Mac or something from the working as well. But I had my trench coat, I carried that, and that was what I treasured, because I knew it was going in the way of his mouth. I was going to enjoy that as well, and not only that, but it was the symbol of my warrant officer class 1 status, which I liked, you know, and I wore that.
Did you feel it was important to make an impression in Civvy Street?
I'm afraid that being a 001, I was always sort of keen about my turnout. And all that, I would never think of going out without polishing my shoes, for example, every day. And I was fastidious in my appearance. And I was always told that if I wanted to, if I wanted to have a decent job, I was told to look smart around the neck, around the collar. And above all, if I didn't have a decent suit, if I had a clean shirt on, you know, and I looked clean at the neck, this is what it said to me, I'd get a job. Or I'd be known as a white collar worker. I'd have a chance of getting a job if I was smarter on the neck. And so I always wore, I always, as soon as I came back into the suit, I was very careful of clean shirt every day. And to look smart on the neck, and also to have proper shoes.
Does
so
any
feeling, yes, turned out to me was I'm afraid I was a bit of a dandy, really. I mean, I went along and adopted a black one with hat when I had that job, and I also had the same purchase in that same morning in this wonderful hatter's, which is still there on the corner of German Street. At St. James's Street, I bought myself an Austrian velour velvet hat as well. Oh, it was smashing.
And this is moving forward a little bit. But at this stage of being demob, what were your feelings about coming back to England?
The responsibility, when I came out of the army, I told myself, I've shed all my responsibility as a senior guy to the army. Although, in a way, I had responsibility to so long, I was now not subject to military law anymore. I realized that I was now subject to civil law, no longer military law, which is different. And I felt a sense of freedom in that respect. Because I wasn't subject to courts martial anymore. You know what I mean? And the military punishments that could be inflicted, even to senior ranks and board officers. If they did something, they could finish up the class house, they're on the double. You know, there's nothing that you had to be fit, and you were really punished with military punishments. Whereas in civil law, you finish up in a jail, and although it was hard labor in those days, but the law was different. I wasn't subject to military law anymore. And that was a bit of a relief, in a way. But I was soon, I soon realized I was disillusioned with City Street, and I was very sorry for a long time that I left the army. And it was touch and go where I was going to go back in because of the exhortation from the Ministry of Defense. I could never stop them, as I said. But then I decided anyway, all sorry, I've got to make a go of it. I didn't have a home. I went back with my parents until I got my senses. My mother had saved, I made an allowance off of the war, and she put what I allowed her in the Post Office Savings Bank. And she saved it all, and she gave it to me, and I loved some. And therefore, that amount of more money, I decided that Wales was the place for me. People came up to me from all over the place. They were mentioned in the statues, and the, shall we call them the town fathers, the ones who were in court in the town, the councillors, you know, the mayor and all those. I knew them, you see, and they knew me, and they came up to me. And one said, "Now, Mr. James, you were a regimental sergeant major one time." He said, "The police force is busy for you. We want a chap like you here to be to police this town. Join the police force. You'll have a marvelous." I said, "No," I said, "as a matter of fact," I said, "I've got bigger aspirations than that." I said, "I'm sorry, I don't know, I don't want that." Then another bloke came on, the headmaster of the local school came on and said, "We've got a scheme for training ex-servicemen to become teachers. We'd like you to join and become a teacher. Take part in the scheme." Well, I said, "It's very kind of you, but I don't intend to stay in Romney." "Oh, where are you going?" Well, I said, "I've heard a lot about Birmingham." I said, "I'm going to go to Birmingham as the number two city." I said, "If I tasted London before the war," I said, "I'm going to go to Birmingham and I'm going to try and build my life and see what I can do there. If you don't like that," I said, "I should be going back to London." "Oh, sorry, leaving the principality again." Well, I said, "I've got nothing in front of me to keep me. I was a single man, single bloke, and I just couldn't settle down, to be honest with you. I had a lazy mind. Having been in the army, I sometimes wonder whether I was a little bit deranged after all these experiences in the army. I had to come back again. I had to sort of get over myself. I was like a fish out of water for a long time. I really was."
And this is even when you re-established yourself in the 40s and 50s.
Yes, I really was like a fish out of water. I missed all the comradeship. I missed the free medical treatment that I had to get the health service at the start of 1948. I missed the free dental treatment. I missed the army looked after you. You were there, you sold yourself to the army, but I missed all that. And I was like a fish in the water. Yeah. I was greatly relieved when the National Health Service started in 1948, when I haven't started it. I thought, well, that's one thing that I got, you know, and so on.
Did you start to miss it straight away?
Immediately. You knew that you didn't have that protection, and you didn't have the army umbrella.
So that was part of the apprehension of going back into City
Street.
Absolutely.
And where am I going? Because I was a single bloke. My parents were getting on and didn't want me there. I didn't want to be a burden to them because they had a small home. I said, "I'm leaving. I'm going to Birmingham." "Oh, sorry, going back yet." "Oh, well, you know, it's your life. Good luck." And I went to Birmingham and I said goodbye in a very short time after I had a few weeks' holiday and testing the old water down there again. This is the place of me. No, my God, this isn't. I can't stay here. ever develop. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And they were a bit concerned. I said, no, in fact, I've got money. I said, I'm big, I'm going to see, I'll do something. And I went, I caught the train via Lamborghini, and I went to Birmingham. And I got out at the Medi station with my case, my belongings, and my super Mac. And I got out of the station and stood on the pavement outside, and somebody said, Jimmy! Immediately! Couldn't believe it! I was looking up and down. Who the hell is this calling Jimmy? Happy here, you silly baba! And there was a long line of buses stationary. And there was a bus driver in the front. He was a sergeant, one of my sergeants. And he opened his window and he says, what the hell are you doing here? I said, I'm just arriving. I said, I want to seek my favourite fortune here. He says, back her off. He says, this is the route for you. He's looking at me as a bloody bus driver. So I said, all right. I said, I'll find something. He said, then he goes, where are you going to stay then? I said, I don't know yet. Oh, he said, he gave me his address. And he says, here, I'm living in Berlin. You've married. I kept his address, but I did never thought I would sort of, you know, keep up with him again. And I never did. I mislaid his address, but he offered his friendship and gave me his address, but I didn't use it. And I found bed and breakfast. And I went into a bed and breakfast, first thing I had to do. And I found bed and breakfast immediately. And there was an officer in his bed and breakfast, and he said, you're certainly honored to hear. He said, so am I. He said, but he said, I'm staying here. He said, I've got a job. He said, where are you working then? Well, I said, I've got a job. I said, it's arrived. Well, he said, there's plenty of jobs at Joseph Lucas factory up in Hanover. He said, they'll fit you up with a job. I said, the pay's not bad, but you'll have to work, and they'll even find you lodgings. So, I thought, oh, that's worth knowing, it's a start anyway. So anyway, I walked around Birmingham, and he was a member of a local rifle club, and he offered me to go with him that evening to have a shoot in this underground rifle club in Birmingham, and I did. Well, I was there. But anyway, I went to Joseph Lucas, and they said they had my war history. They knew what I was, and they said, well, we haven't got much of a responsible job here. They said, I've got a job, it's important, it's semi-clerical. I said, you'll have to dirty your hands, but he said, you know, this is a place of work. He says, do you mind doing a job dirtying your hands? I said, no, I said, I don't mind, as long as I've got a job and then prospects. Oh, you'll be under Mr. Flavel, I remember his name. You'll be under Mr. Flavel. He's in our most important part of the Berkshire. I said, what's that then? He says, the returned goods side. He says, where our agents throughout the country are returning enormous big wooden boxes containing magnetos and starters and starter motors and things like that. He said, which have come back for reconditioning or service exchange. He said, you'll be in charge of the return.
Now, before we get into that, you mentioned that the employer would have your career details from the army. Would that be like a test? How would that work? Would there be a testimonial letter?
I had my army release book. And the army release book is the full truth in there. You've got your army release book. You've got things that you sort of tear out for, and you get the stamps when you draw your gratuity for the post office, and you think a remaining page that is forever there has got your testimonial, your character by your commanding officer when you leave the army.
Is that the last commanding officer that you had?
The last commanding officer.
So if you were a soldier that wasn't with the unit for very long, you could be...
You would be out of luck. Captain Weston didn't know me very well. But he gave me a fantastic reference that I commanded the company in his absence, that I was diligent and would be sorely missed, and, you know, and it was a wonderful testimony.
And you knew what this was yourself. You could read it yourself, wasn't it?
That's why I had to give this to my employer.
Did you with other veterans? Were there other men that maybe didn't get a good testimonial? Would that be?
Everybody.
Would they try always to?
Well, I got a fantastic testimonial because I did a good job at the old Garrison Company. Now, there you are, you see. No one had gone before. And so the bloke who gave me the reference was old Garrison Company commander.
And he wouldn't know anything about the deal?
Well, not much at all.
Only what you
knew. He only knew me for 6 months. But we got them together. And Captain Westland, and I did a first-class job, and he was really sorry he missed me and let me go. But nothing of your form now. No, well, you see, everybody, you work it out. It's very, very few stays with one battalion in the war. You're a casualty very soon. And you started off, if you were wounded and you were downgraded, you didn't go back to that battalion, you were one of these chaps put to work in something, the army. There were 9 men keeping the 1 man in the line, and you were part of the army in all this many other activities. But you're quite right, you hit the nail right on the head. And I thought of it at the time, I've got nothing to show what I've done in the war here. I've merely got a reference of the bloke who's deluded me for the last few months. And it's quite true. That was one of the things. Nobody ever bothered, because I often show my character reference to them. Nobody wanted to see them. They didn't want to know.
And just staying on this subject of the soldiers' release book. What else was in it?
Exemplary conduct. Your army rank and name, length of service, and I have known CSM James. For the last 6 months, he's been my commissar major. His willingness to sort of take over the company in my absence, and all his business, and he put nothing but good. And he constructed this reference, and he said, "Out of that, commissar major, I said, very kind of you, sir. You haven't been very long, but I said, my goodness me, that should get me a plum job." He said, "That's how I've done it."
On your DMOB, can you remember what your gratuity was?
Yes, £112 after all that service, £112, it was so much a month. And I worked it out since, and I never looked at it then. Do you know what they did? They worked out my gratuity as if I was Group 28, and they forgot that I was a 7-year man. But the difference is about £6. I've never bothered to pursue it. I've got debt share. Where my gratuity, so many months. I should have 7 years and a month. I should have 7 to 84. I should have 85 months. And you've only given me a gratuity for 70 something months. They worked out my bloody pay as if I was a conscript leading in Group 28. And I've still got the evidence of it. And I've been, after all these years, still was running back then. But I'm only about £6 adrift, you know. Yes, it's worked out according to the month, so much month. According to your rank, I'm £12.
So the sergeant you met in Birmingham, where was he from?
He was one of the sergeants who was on the training staff of the IRTD in the south of Italy, who had known me, you know, all the time I was down there in the IRTD. And he was quite a character. And I was surprised that he was there as a kind of bus driver. I got a photograph of the IRTD about your permanent staff. We all just say put slightly, and he's on that picture, you know, and he's very well known to me.
So would he be an example of a man who had responsibility in the army, who was like taking a step down, do you think?
That's right, he was on the training staff at the IRTD, disabled, he'd been in action, And he was one of the ones like me who had to sort of endure the life at the reinforcement depot, which wasn't a good life at all to anybody. I've been reading in the DLI book about the DLI chefs going to Egypt and regarding everybody who had, was a base roller as, they have no respect for them at all. And I told you about that, I think, in the previous thing before I read that book, which of course is really good to show that the life of a base roller is really nothing to sort of boast about. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But those chaps had been in action and had done their duty and had to do the duty in base. There's nothing they could do about it. But it's nothing. I wouldn't. If I had the time over again, I would do my utmost to avoid that.
When you were demobbed, on this theme of responsibility in the army and apprehension about civvy straight,
yes.
Did you feel that you didn't want to that you didn't want to like step back or step down? Did you feel that you'd learned so much and or what was your feelings about?
Coincidentally, now you've asked a question, and I can tell you now. I told you, I think, that I found a job I'm not sure anything about that, which is advertised as an assistant manager. And it turned out to be an assistant field manager. The bloke who was the field manager was a corporal in the army, and he hated my guts. And he was my boss.
And he hated you because?
And he hated my guts because I was a warrant officer. And he had been a corporal, and he had been badly treated by his warrant officer, who threw a rifle at him one day and said, "Catch that," and he missed it, and it hit him in the head. And he hated the army, and he hated warrant officers, and there was I, saddled to work with him. His name was Harold Lawson. I've never forgotten him or forgiven him. He stopped my promotion, you know. And eventually he realized my worth, and I became a rep. And eventually he apologized to me on the stand in Birmingham. Says, "Jim, I remember the early days that you were with us. I want to apologize to you now. I've never had the guts to do so." But he said, "I was unfair to you."
And so at this stage, ex-servicemen, you would naturally talk to each other about what you did, where you'd been.
I eventually learned not to tell them what I was. I kept it dark. I wouldn't tell anybody because I knew that they were not popular.
That was CSMs and RSMs.
CSMs and RSMs. I for a long time, hid the fact that I was a warrant officer in the army.
Being a colour sergeant, was okay?
I hid it all. I didn't talk for a long time because I knew that I was rubbing somebody up. You know, the world was full of them. And I could see it.